Justin.
Justin.
Just in time for a meeting. Woohoo! All right, let's have an AA meeting. Hi, my name is Misty, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hey,
Misty. Hi. Welcome to the Monday Night Blue Chip Speakers meeting at the NABA Club, where a member of Alcoholics Anonymous with 1 year or more of sobriety tells his story, his or hers, but tonight it's his story. This reading is based on a passage from 29 of the big books of Alcoholics Anonymous. Each individual in our personal stories describe their own language from their own point of view, the way they establish their relationship with God. These give a fair cross-section of our membership and a clear-cut idea of what has happened in their lives. We hope that no one will consider these self-revealing accounts in bad taste. Our hope is that many alcoholic men and women in our room tonight and listening later on AABlueChipSpeakers.org, desperately in need, will hear our speaker, and we believe that it's only by fully disclosing ourselves and our problems that any of us shall be persuaded to say, yes, I'm one of them too, and I must have this thing. I've been waiting literally a year to hear this man tell his story. So all the way from Think It Through group right here at NABA, I'd like to introduce Alex.
Hey everybody, I'm Alex. I'm alcoholic.
Alex.
I'm honored and I'm humbled to be up here tonight, and that I was asked to do this. You know, you said something before you even said the Serenity Prayer. Let's pause and take a moment and think about why we're here. And the only word that came to my head was God. That's the only reason I'm here. I love this building. I love NABA. I love the people here. Coming up here to tell my story is not something that I have to do alone. There's people in this room who have been behind me from the beginning, and there's people that couldn't make it tonight that are praying for me. And, you know, the fact that I could even go to people and ask them to pray for me is just a testimony of this program. You know, not being comfortable doing something is not something that, before I came in here, I would have ever admitted. You know, I had this facade that everything was fine and I got this, and that's been broken. So yeah, I'm grateful. My sobriety date is February 11th, 2021. I came through those doors into this place, and it was not the first time I had been in here. I have tried several times before this to get sober, but the timing wasn't right. It wasn't my time. I have tried and tried to get sober on my own from an early age. I think about the first time shit really hit the fan. I was 17, came up with the bright idea that I needed to switch high schools, right? Like that would fix my problem. It was the people I was around. And, you know, tracking back even before that, you know, at an early age, I had this, I call it an identity crisis. I would never felt comfortable in my skin. And we hear that a lot when someone comes up here and tells their story. I'm not unique, but I grew up in a loving family. I had great parents that are still together. They've been married almost 40 years, a brother and a sister. We grew up in church. We were part of First Baptist Church of Atlanta, and that meant we were there a lot, and I didn't like that at all. So as soon as I was old enough to make my own choices, I ran away from that. But, you know, I think that my dependency on chemicals to make me feel normal started before I was doing drugs. It was I was diagnosed with ADHD like in fourth grade, and I was wild. I could not sit still. I didn't have the willpower to do homework. I just didn't care. And then I went and saw a doctor, and they gave me some medicine, and all of a sudden I was like fixed. You know, like all those problems went away with opening up a pill bottle and taking that pill. And I don't hold that against anybody. That was the culture in that time. That's still our culture today. So it's nobody's fault. But that kind of set this tone in my mind that, like, one, there's something wrong with you. You're not like everybody else. And two, if you take this, then you can be fixed and be normal. And I carried that with me for about 20 more years. I think I was a blackout drinker from the very start. I don't ever remember a time of just hanging out, having a couple beers, and calling it a night. I think that from the very beginning, I was drinking like we drink. As a young kid, I mean, at the age of 14, I put myself in the hospital. I think I blacked out every time I drank in high school. You know, so then I started trying to do other things to not have to drink as much, so not have the consequences. That's where drugs came into play. But when I turned 17, it kind of hit the fan in our household and with me. And so we decided, hey, Alex will go to a new school. He'll start his senior year fresh, and he'll be fixed. And, you know, that worked for a year. There was a year that I didn't use or drink, and you know, I was 18 and wasn't partying. I was going on self-will, and I thought that had kind of tackled that problem. But I quickly went to college, and that was a disaster in itself. That was a really bad 3 or 4 months. That was my first college experience. I remember calling my dad before finals the first semester, and I said, "Look, man, you got to come get me. This is out of control." I had been in a blackout for 3 months and never went to class, and caused a lot of destruction too. You know, like when I would get in these blackouts, like there's no telling what I would do. I would wind up in jail. I would, total vehicles. I'd get in fights. I'd say really horrible things to people. A lot of stuff that I'm not proud of. So I moved back home, and I started working a job at a car dealership and living with my parents, and I was just getting by. I was still drinking exactly how I wanted to drink. I was doing drugs how I wanted to do drugs. I had a little bit of money in my pocket, and for me, the more money I make, the more I use. There's just a correlation there, and it's been like that my whole life. There was never an amount that I could do to be satisfied. If there was more, I was going to do it, and if I could acquire more, I was going to use more. So I decided to go back to school when I was 21. I enrolled at Georgia State, and I did really well for a little bit, and then things started spiraling out of control again. I was smoking a lot of pot, just a lot of pot, and I had a girlfriend that she was okay with it at the time. You know, there was other stuff that I had to hide from her, but it got out of control, and I started putting myself in the hospital a whole lot. From the time I was probably 22 to 28, I don't know how many times I was in the hospital. I really couldn't put a number on it. If I had to guess, it'd be about 50 or 60. I know one year in particular, I was admitted into the hospital from the ER 13 times. So, like, there's, a difference from going to the ER and being brought to the hospital room where you stay for, 2 days to 8 days. But there was a lot. I spent a lot of time in the hospital, and to this day, I think that I have some PTSD being around hospitals. There's something about the smell that just, like, it just brings this trauma feeling back, and God's worked on that. I've taken sponsees to the hospital since then and had to sit through that. And that's one of the ways that God has worked. I got a girlfriend when I was 19, and we dated until I was 26, and that spiraled. You know, she was a great girl, and that was kind of, for the time being, that was my identity. I was this dude who had the cool girlfriend, and we had this great life, and it was all a facade. You know, looking back at it with hindsight, the intervention that my family had with her to get her to leave me was a gift from God, because if we would have wound up married and having kids, our lives have just gone in such different directions. God has pulled me one way, and he's led her in a completely different way. So I look at that as grace and saving a lot of heartache. As bad as it was at the time, it's a beautiful thing right now. So I almost made it out of college my second time. I went for 4 years, and I did really well. I was getting a history degree because that was the easy way out, which is kind of the route that I always took. If I could do something with minimal effort, that was the route I would choose. And I got to the end there, and I had 13 hours left to graduate, and I just was so sick. I put myself in the hospital, and this time it was worse than it had ever been. I ended up staying in there for 8 or 9 days. I had my gallbladder removed at one point. It was so bad, I had ulcers throughout my whole body, and ended up having what I found out was a hole in my colon. It was a big hole. I never really got the severity. I never understood the severity of the situation. I was so delusional during all this, and so of the mindset that, well, it's not that big of a deal. I'll get through it. Everything's always worked out in the past, because it had. God always just showed provision when I would blow my life up, and I had this hedge of protection over my life that I can look back and see now, and this was no different. This was one of the first moments that I really experienced a supernatural act of God, and I didn't even notice it at the time. Looking back, it blows my mind. But I was going in for surgery at 6 a.m. one morning. They decided to run one more scan of my body to see what was going on and how bad it was. And they were going to put a colostomy bag on me that I would wear for the rest of my life. My family came in and prayed over me, and I went to get the scan, and the surgeon pulled me, and he said, "Hey, man, you know, I've been doing this 32 years. I've never seen anything like this, but your hole has disappeared. It's gone." I was like, go me. I thought I was special. I really didn't take it as an act of God at the time. I didn't show any gratitude for it. I looked at it as, well, like, I'm just built different. I'm made for this life. And I went on about my business. About 6 months later, it got really bad again. And I had another, like, one of those explosive moments where my whole life has fallen apart and I really, really think I surrender. You know, those, like, half-hearted surrenders where you're like, I will totally give this up. But this stuff over here, like, I'm still managing this. So I had this doctor. He was like, look, Alex, like, your body is decrepit. You know, your insides, you look like a 70-year-old homeless man who's been on the streets for 50 years. And I was like, what do I do? He goes, well, you need to not drink for, like, a long time. I was like, all right, well, we'll call it 6 weeks. And I did that. I held to that. I did not pick up a drink. I did a lot of other stuff, but I did not drink for 6 weeks. And then 6 weeks in one day, I go into a blackout and put myself back in the hospital. But I thought, you know, in my managing my alcoholism, I thought, I can just put it down for 6 weeks, no problem. Like, I've got this. That should have been a telltale sign, but like I said, I wasn't writing the timeline of these events. It was God's story, and it took another, you know, I was probably 26 at that point. There was a lot of hard years after that before I finally surrendered. I was sick all the time, so I couldn't work, right? And so I finally got a job with this guy. He was a friend of the family's, and he was doing remodels, and he was just, like, enabling me. He said, hey, man, come on and work when you feel like it. And so I did, and I learned a lot. I wasn't making any money. I was living with my parents at 26 and totally ashamed of myself. But, like, on the outside, when I would have conversations with people, I carried myself in a way that looked like I've got it all together, because I was just, you know, a master manipulator, and I didn't want people to know how much I was hurting, because then I'd have to do something about it, right? Like, if other people knew the suffering I was going through, they'd get on my case, and I'd feel pressure to get sober, and the thought of getting sober and turning my life around, I knew it was going to be a tall task, and I thought it was something that I had to do on my own with willpower. I didn't understand this program or God or how any of this stuff works at the time. And then I got a job from there working for my boss, who I work for today. It's been like 10 years. And with that job came, like, more pride and more money and a lot more, like, fuel to my ego. And I saw with more money came my own house and my own freedom, as I called it, and the ability to do whatever I wanted whenever I wanted. And that got really dangerous. A lot of other substances came into play. It was really dark, you know, and I would still show up to family events. I was rough, but I thought I was holding it all together, and things got really, really dark there. When I was 28, I developed a heroin habit. I thought that I could manage it. I thought, well, I'm not going to shoot it. It'll be fine. I'm smarter than everybody else. It won't be a problem. And sure enough, it was a problem, a very expensive problem. I was living with this shame of trying to put on this facade for people that I had it together, and people knew I was rough, but they didn't know the depths of my suffering, and they didn't know the misery that I was walking in every day. They didn't know the shame I was carrying because I didn't tell anybody. There was a lot of times where I was using, and I was like, you know, if I do too much and I don't wake up tomorrow, hallelujah, like, that's my way out. That was the only escape that I saw. I couldn't imagine walking through that and getting to the other side. It just seemed like too tall of a task. I thought I was too far gone. I thought that I wasn't worth it. And all this time, I had a loving family that was still behind me until they weren't. I got to a point where I finally burned those bridges. And that's later on in the story. But, you know, around the time I turned 30, I'm miserable. I'm like a shell of myself. I can't look at myself in the mirror. I go to brush my teeth and I turn around and stare at the shower because that mirror, I just see like this person who I'd become, and it was unbearable. And I was walking around with that every day, trying to hide it from the world. And that's a shame that is just, it's from hell. I mean, it really is. It's just miserable. So I turn 30 and I decide, hey, it's time to get my life together. And I was really bad. I remember I ran out of money, like totally, I mean, depleted my savings. I was out of things to sell, places to borrow. I had just run that course. And I showed up at my parents' house and I just laid it all out, you know, as much as I thought they could handle. I didn't tell them everything, but I felt like I was being honest for the first time. I wasn't fully being honest. I wasn't capable of that yet. I hadn't learned that from you guys of how to be honest. But I locked myself in their bathroom for 6 days and did a detox that way. And I would not recommend that to anybody. It was dangerous. I was coming off of alcohol, heroin, cocaine, Xanax, Ativan, everything. I laid in a shower for 5 days straight, didn't sleep, had seizures. I was very naive and thought that I literally believed that I was built different, and I was so delusional to the severity of my addiction and my alcoholism. I was still blinded from these lies. So that's 5 days. On the sixth day, it's Sunday, and this is where God kind of steps in again. My dad came and knocked on the door, and I'm just like in a state of delusion. I mean, I hadn't slept in 5 days. I'm literally still withdrawing and detoxing, and it's like my bones hurt. You know, if you all have ever been through that, but it's like your bones are like achy. I feel like I'd cried all my. I felt like I was dehydrated, not from not drinking, but from crying so much. And he said, "Hey, I'm going to church. Why don't you try to get it together and show up?" I said, "Okay." I don't know. I don't know how I made it there. I really don't. I just remember sitting in a chair, gripping the chair in front of me with white knuckles, pouring sweat. Didn't hear a word the whole time until the end. And the pastor said something that I clung to. I clung to this. He said, "If you still have breath in your lungs, God's not finished with you." And I believe that. That was the first glimmer of hope I had experienced in a while. And so after the service, I ran back to this little access space. And I was just like, "Guys, I need someone to pray for me. I feel like shit, and I hate myself, and I want to die." And this guy named Dana just happened to approach me. And at the time, he had 9 years sober. And that was a God thing. And he was very, very honest with me. I kind of told him a little bit of my story and where I was. And he said, "Well, Alex, I'm not trying to pull the pastoral card, but you need to go to an intense rehab." And I was like, "Let me pray about it." he was like, "No, man, I'm telling you what you need to do if you want to get better." And so I did. 2 days later, I checked into a rehab. And, man, it was awesome. It was like a 30-day vacation for my problems. Didn't work on anything. I got really close to God, and I had this delusion that, like, with God on my side, I could tackle all this. I didn't want any fellowship. I didn't want to get honest with anybody. But I came out of there, and I felt good. You know, I remember my dad picked me up, and I'm on the way home, like, going through my cell phone, like, looking who I can call and tell that I'm fixed. I'm like, I'm better, you know, after 30 days in treatment, after, you know, 20 years of this life, I'm fixed. And that's just, that shows how naive I was. And you know, I stayed sober that time for 8 months. I came into the rooms. I never got a sponsor. I told people I had a sponsor. I couldn't imagine getting honest and telling people what was really going on, though. I was carrying these things that I had done in this life that I had lived, and it was, in my head, it was so dark that nobody else would understand, because I wasn't listening when I came in the rooms. I was sitting there feeling sorry for myself, and I didn't hear you guys telling my story from up here. And so I stayed sober for 8 months, and it was like a go Alex thing. You know, everybody was behind me, and, you know, and then something came up, I picked up, and I started using again, and I didn't tell anybody. And I was living this lie, and that lasted two more years of me using and everybody thinking that I was sober still. And that, the shame from that was unbearable. That was probably the most miserable shame. And I've done and experienced a lot of things that don't need to be talked about up here, because that's not the point of this. But the shame that comes from living the lie after you've gotten a little taste of AA is unbearable. And that came to a screeching halt of February of 2021. The Christmas before that, I had gotten a very nice cash bonus from my boss, and I cashed it, and the whole month of January, I spent laid up in my house doing nitrous, and I spent over $5,000 on nitrous that month. And I was hiding from the world. I was hiding from myself. I was trying to suppress the shame the only way I knew how. Thank God I never picked up dope, because I would have killed myself with it. But it was a really, really dark month. And, you know, that definitely was not the worst it had ever been. But it was the time that God said, all right, I'm done. Like, we're through with this. We're going to move on to the next part of your life. And it wasn't anything I did. It was, like, the timing of it was divine, because I had been through a lot worse scenarios than that. But I was just, I just had enough. And God was like, all right, now I'm going to pull you out of this. So February 10th of 2021, I'm going over to my parents' house to BS them that I'm okay and that my life is good and that I'm working and everything's fine. And I end up getting pulled over on my parents' street because I had expired tags, which came from a lapse of insurance, which came from a speeding ticket I didn't pay 2 years prior, because I didn't have to deal with that kind of stuff like everybody else. I was so arrogant. And so I end up going down to DeKalb County and sitting in there for about 28 hours or so. And during that time, I was having a sciatica flare-up. I was going through nitrous withdrawals, which I didn't know were a thing until then. And I was just miserable. And I remember being in that jail cell thinking, like, God, if you get me out of this, I'll do whatever it takes. And at that moment, I realized how powerless I was over drinking, drugs, self-will. I was powerless over my ego. I was completely powerless. I was powerless over women. And at that point, I gave up. I called my boss, because my dad wasn't going to bail me out this time. He was done. I mean, he had drawn the line. He said, I'm not giving you another dollar. So I called my boss and I said, look, man, I'm down here and I really need some help. And they put up the cash bond and got me out, and I came here that night. It was Sunday, and I came to the Sunday 8 o'clock meeting, and I just sat right back there and didn't say a word. I was miserable. I was so miserable, and I was so broken. I saw people in here. I saw some people in here that I had seen the first time I tried, and they were still here, and I thought that was weird. So the next day, I wake up, and I go to work. About 1 o'clock rolls around, so I come back up here for the 1:30 meeting, and I sit right over there again, and I just kind of open my mouth and said, look, I'm broken, I'm done, I don't know what to do. And some people came up to me after the meeting and said, hey, you're going to be okay, like, we're here. And that sparked something. That sparked a little bit of hope. People came behind me and supported me when I had no... I didn't believe in myself. I didn't really believe in the program. These people saw me. They saw I was broken, and they came to rally behind me, and they didn't even know me. And that kind of blew me away. So I started coming back every day at 1:30. I made that my home group. I started hanging out with some old-timers, just absorbing, you know, just absorbing this. And I got really honest, and I started opening up, and I started interjecting myself into these little circles that happened in the parking lot, you know. And that's, like, the most awkward thing that a person can do. Especially when your brain is fried, you don't know how to put a sentence together, but you're like, oh, yeah, I get it. And I've learned that, like, being uncomfortable in here is a good thing, because that's where the growth happens. That's where you step out on faith and you allow God to do what God does, and then you come back with this experience of how God has filled in these gaps. God put a lot of people in my life. Man, it was crazy, like how much I was able to dive in because I had all this support. And I did. I dove right in. I got a sponsor, and I got to work. For the first time in my life, I was really honest about where I was and how I was feeling and how much I hated myself. And that was stuff that I never thought I would tell anybody else. I got into service immediately. I completely unqualified, not knowing what I was doing. There was a suggestion that I go out. I was 5 or 6 days sober. It was on a Thursday, so I guess I was about 5 days sober. Someone said, hey, why don't you go out here in the streets and hand out food and help people that are living on the streets? And I was like, okay, that's a suggestion. I'm taking suggestions, so I'll do it. And I did it. And man, immediately I realized how much grace I had been shown in my life, because the decisions that wound people up in those circumstances under bridges were the same decisions that I had been making for 20 years, and I was spared from that for whatever reason. It has nothing to do with me. It's just God. He didn't allow me to go there, and I'm grateful for that. But I was given this, I don't want to call it a confidence, but it was almost a confidence in God that he was going to do something. And so I made a commitment that Thursday that every week I'm going to go out and I'm going to serve people on the streets. And that radically changed my life. It changed my heart. That was a focal point of my recovery. Just getting outside of myself, no matter how miserable I was feeling or how sorry for myself I was feeling, I could go out there and I'd see people in these environments, and I'd come home and take a hot shower and I'd just start sobbing with gratitude. It was like the first good tears I ever remember crying. Just grateful tears. And that was, you know, that was a first. That happened because of that experience. So I'm doing all that, and I dive into the steps, and I get a book, I start reading it with a sponsor, and we just get to work. And it went by quick with hindsight. It really did. It was we did one step a week. And, you know, for some people that's too fast. For some people that's not fast enough. For me, it at the time, it felt right. I'll never forget, you know, moments of that. My first step experience was, I had a first step experience in jail, but really meditating on it while working the step with a sponsor. He said, why don't you, it was clear I was powerless. I made that very clear, but I hadn't conveyed how unmanageable my life was. So he said, why don't you write down 10 ways your life's unmanageable? And so I really thought about it, and I got a pen on paper, and I had 10 pages of unmanageability. Every aspect of my life was unmanageable. Even the stuff I was managing, like my job, paying rent, all that stuff, I was only managing to protect my addiction. If I didn't have the money coming in, if I didn't have the place to use, I wouldn't have, you know, I would have had to not use drugs and alcohol to feel better. And so it got down to the root of that. Everything in my life was built for me to use and drink the way that I wanted to. Even the stuff that I might have got an attaboy for, like showing up to work. I mean, it wasn't because I wanted to go. It was because I had to go to work to get money to pay for my addiction. So my whole life was built around protecting that. The house that I had that I thought was my little freedom place was actually my prison that I stayed locked in on, not talking to anybody. It was just miserable. But I think about, really in jail, backtracking to that, I think I did the first 3 steps in jail. I had that glimmer of hope that God could bring me out of this. I had no idea what it was going to look like. But that's why I showed up here. That's why I came here seeking help, because I had something in me that said, if you surrender and you ask for help, I will bring the help that you need. And I had a peace about that. And that brought me in here, and it got me to a place of vulnerability to where I could go to other men and say, dude, I don't know what I'm doing. Like, my life is in shambles and I desperately need help. So I tried to stay in the service role because it got me so outside of myself. And about 8 months into that, I had a meeting with the COO of the ministry that we were part of, and he asked me if I wanted to lead it. And I was like, you know, at this point I had worked the steps and I had gotten friends, and it just, I didn't think I was qualified, but I felt God saying, step out here and I'll meet you. And I'd known from God's track record that that was what he always had done. If he called me to do something and I stepped out on faith, he met me right where I was and walked me through it. I really believe that if we are called somewhere by God, then he is going to bring provision and equip us for that. It's not on us. And thank God for that. I really was engulfed in these rooms. I surrounded myself with people in here that were a little bit further along than me, but were still doing the deal and walking the walk. And somehow they didn't think I was so weird that I couldn't hang out with them when I would stand outside the circles and try to laugh when they laughed and smoke cigarettes when they smoked cigarettes. And we started hanging out, and that's what happens in here. You start going, people ask you to go to lunch, and whether you want to go or not or feel comfortable, you say yes and you go and you start making connections. And I'm so grateful that I was willing to say yes to those meals and to those experiences, because those are the people that I still have in my corner today. I experienced a lot of firsts with people from AA. I never knew a life outside of partying and drugs, and I never would have imagined that any of it would be fun without that until I started hanging out with these people. You know, I had my first pool parties with people at AA. I went to my first Braves game sober with people in AA. I did all these things that I never thought that I would be capable of doing with the support of other people walking this thing. I'm so grateful for that. That first year really, really flew by. Steps flew by. I'm so grateful for the way that the steps work and having a sponsor to explain that to me and the order in it and to push me to get fully honest. When I was working my fourth step, man, there were things that I would have sworn that I would never open my mouth and talk about. There were things that I was perfectly okay with taking to the grave, you know, stuff that I had done and wrongs I had done and the way I was living and the stuff that was the root of so much shame. And, you know, God was graceful to give me the courage to speak that out. And something happens when I tell on myself. I don't know the science behind it, but something is lifted. There is a burden that was almost immediately removed when I told myself on some of this stuff. And I remember driving back from my sponsor's house after reading all my stuff, and I felt like my car was like floating down the highway. If that makes sense. I mean, I literally felt like elevated to some point. And not everybody has that experience. I don't know why I had it was such a good experience, but it was for me. And so I encourage anybody to get really honest with that. I worked through all that, and then I got to my amends, and I thought, okay, this is where I was really nervous about that, because there was a lot of bridges that I had burnt. There was relationships with family members that were non-existent. They wanted nothing to do with me. I was cut off from the family. And a lot of that stuff was not resolved with the conversation. And that was something that I had to accept that I was powerless over. The relationship with my brother and sister was not mended with a, I'm sorry. There was no conversation about that. I was advised to live a life in sobriety and live up to my calling and not tell anybody about what I was doing, but just let them see it from the sidelines. And he assured me that eventually they would come back around, and that is what happened. It took a lot longer than I wanted it to. But eventually I started hearing from other people, hey, you know, your brother's kind of asking about you. He was curious about this and that. And I'm like, well, what'd you tell him? Like, well, we told him the truth. And he started crying. And I was like, okay, God, I see you. And I had to let go of the control of that, because in my past, I've always been this master manipulator. And I've been so slick at talking my way out of stuff, you know, like totaling vehicles at 3 a.m. and getting away with it without a DUI, you know, like the way that my disease would overtake and put these lies out of my mouth just to get what I wanted was, I mean, it's shocking. It really is shocking, but this was not something that I could manipulate. I had to let God do his work, and that was a very humbling process that I will forever be grateful for. And today, you know, my family is restored. My relationships with my brother and sister are mended. We spend weekends together, and that's it's just a blessing. I came in here, I remember just sobbing back there about not being able to see my little niece. And people told me, they said, keep coming, keep doing what you're doing, and that will fix. And they were right. And they told me that from their experience. They weren't guessing at it. You know, they weren't just like throwing that out there. And they had lived that, and you guys had experienced what I was experiencing. And so I got comfort and advice and counsel from you guys. When I got sober, I knew that it was going to be a complete overhaul of my lifestyle. I was aware of that. I never would have imagined that I would be blessed in this way. It's been 2.5 years, and things just keep getting better. And I heard people say that when I came in. They're like, just wait. My sponsor told me, just wait. It'll just keep getting better. And I was like, there's no way. I'm not waking up sick. I'm not having to chase down money and do things for money and steal and manipulate all this stuff. He was like, well, just wait. It's going to get better than that. I promise. And that's what's happened. You know, because of this program, because of these relationships, you know, I was brought to Unity Weekend up in Highlands, and I've been back up there 4 or 5 times now. But I remember the first time I went up there, there was a girl up there, and I remember thinking, my God, I want to marry that woman. I remember thinking that, and I thought, there's no way. She's just too much. She's got too much going for her. She was an inspiration. She inspired me to get deeper into recovery, and we just became really good friends. And a year passed, and we started dating. And then another year passed, and I was able to propose to her up there at Unity Weekend. And that's, you know, that's just one of dozens of examples of blessings that have come from this way of life and from grace. We're in the process of moving into a new home that we have all the money for up front. We're not scrambling to get our finances. And I mean, God has just, we have done the work. I've done the work, and I've shown up, and it's not because I'm special. It's because I took this really seriously when I came in here, because I wanted to radically change my life. And you guys told me if I did this stuff, then I could have that radical change. And I believed you. And so we're getting married in October. We're moving into a new home in July. We've experienced things together that have brought us closer. I had to put down my dog in last October, and I didn't want to even think about drinking over it. You know, that was my little buddy. He'd been through it all. The thought of drinking never came up. It just brought us closer together. So I'm grateful for that. Now we got a crazy puppy who's really bad, and we love him anyway. But this program has given me a life beyond what I could comprehend, and it keeps shifting. The deeper I get into this, the more time I have, the more I think I have it together. God is continually shining lights in these little dark corners of my heart and revealing that there's a lot more work to be done. I don't think that this is a thing to where all of a sudden I'll have it all together. From my experience, as soon as I get through working through an issue, there's like 3 more things that are revealed, and it's all rooted in selfishness, because to the core, I am selfish. But God's bringing about opportunities to work through. With my service commitment with the outreach, that's kind of shifted, and now there's a whole new opportunity that just presented itself. I felt I was being called in a different direction. I really prayed about it, and 2 weekends ago, a guy came up to me and said, hey, we're starting this project where they've just rescued girls out of trafficking down, you know, from the streets, and he knew that I had experience with that, and so he asked me to kind of bring the team out there, a team of very capable men, to execute this stuff. And it's so humbling that God has called someone like me with my past and my history and my selfishness to be a part of this mission, not just in the rooms of AA, but outside of that, like kingdom assignments. It's overwhelming, and I don't think that it'll ever get old. I don't see this getting to a point where it's like, this is cool. Like, I think that I will forever be in awe of the power of Alcoholics Anonymous and my recovery. And, you know, like I said, it doesn't mean that everything's good. Most things are really good. I've got a lot of high-class problems today, but there's still some some deep-rooted patterns that I have to continually work through. And the beautiful thing is that today I'm okay with working through them. I'm not content with where I'm at, and that's because of these rooms. When something comes up, I'm able to recognize it and get to work on it. With the suggestion of a fiancé. It's like, you know, she's gung-ho. She's gung-ho, and I need that. I need that push. It's a humbling process to see that this is going to be a forever thing, that there will always be work to be done. And I'm grateful that I can put my boots on and go to work today and take action against this stuff, because for the longest time I felt so helpless. But you guys showed me that there's a way to work through all this stuff that comes up. So I'm grateful. I'm grateful particularly for this room. This is where it all started for me. Right over there, just sobbing, you know, to being asked to come up here and talk to you guys. You know, it's really wild. So I'm excited for what's next. Thank y'all so much for this.
That was worth a whole year, I'm telling you. Thank you. Thank you so much. Very humbling. Thank you for giving God the glory and the program of AA. Great story, Alex. I enjoyed it.
There's a well-known affliction, better known as addiction. Takes everything you got, including your ambition. Has a real long history, but still it's a mystery. It's all you think about becomes your priority. You lose your self-control, you dig yourself a hole. You'll do anything to feed it, even sell your soul. It's a daily obsession, a fatal progression. The way to feel yourself is with the true confession. It affects all races, has so many faces. Like how food and sex is all the same disgraces. It's the sin strike. Addiction ruins your life. And the sad thing about it, you won't even think twice. It occupies your mind. It's like you're doing time. Every time you turn around, you're spending every dime. You place your family last and use them up real fast. It's hard to face reality, therefore you live in the past. It's so much confusion, a life of delusion. You think you're doing fine, but it is just an illusion. It's a life of shame, and leaves you feeling lame. The price for your addiction costs you nothing but pain. Come out of the darkness, come into the light. Come on, walk by faith and not by sight. Come out of the darkness, come into the light. It's time to throw away the needle and put down the pipe. Come out of the darkness, come into the light. Because darkness cannot survive in the light.
There are no rules on the street, so be quick on your feet. Every corner that you turn, no telling who you could meet. So many faceless names and nameless faces doing real crazy things, and they leave no traces. Now Freddy is dead.
What?
That's what I said. He took the wrong man's money and was shot in the head. There was this girl named Beth, strung out on pills and meth. Addiction took a lot, just 17 at a death. She had a friend named Jack, he was addicted to crack. He took his very first hit and he never came back. Let's not forget about Paul, he loved that alcohol. He had a head on collision, killed a baby and all. Last night Chris took Corey's life. When they arrested him, the blood was still on the knife.
Come on,
my votes are separated from the kids and wife. One is in the ground, the other's doing right. Corey was stabbed in his heart for his money and dope. Chris was really strung out, and he had lost all hope. I can't believe I killed my friend, that's what he said in the note. The guards found Chris' body hanging from a rope.
Come out of the darkness, come into the light.
Come on,
walk by faith and not by sight. Come out of the darkness, come into the light. It's time to throw away the needle and put down the pipe. Come out of the darkness, come into the light. Because darkness cannot survive in the light.
Drugs are not true at all, so don't believe all the hype. It was in 1991 when I put down the pipe. You see, I had this affliction, better known as addiction. Took everything I had, including my ambition. I was sick and tired of being sick and tired. Every chance that I got of being sick and wired. I found some people like me, they said they found the key. The information that they gave me helped to set me free. So now I do what I can to help my fellow man. The
Master said I sure is their recovery plan. You see, I once was lost, but today I'm found. I've no desire to get high, my feet are on the ground. If it can happen for me, then it can happen for you. You see, you're really not alone, your life can be brand new. So if you're sick and tired of being sick and tired, every chance that you get of being sick and wide. And if you want to be free, that is the remedy. You're only 12 steps away from your recovery. The others like yourself, who got themselves some help. And the only way to keep it is to help someone else. No need to suffer no more. See, once you open the door, you'll find everything you need. Need I say more?
Come out of the darkness, come into the light.
Come on,
walk by faith and not by sight.
Come
out of the darkness, come into the light. It's time to throw away the needle and put down the pipe.
Come
out of the darkness, come into the light. Because darkness cannot survive in the light.
Come
out of the darkness, come into the light. Walk by faith and not by sight.